can keep a, an eye on that little thing to pop up in case, I think there's what, one or two more that might come on, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, I got Frank and Jeff that may or may not show up.
Okay. All right. Did my screen just freeze up? Okay, now can you hear me? Computer. All right. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd like to call to order the Kaiser City Council. It is Monday, February 8th, 2021. And Matt.
Yeah, go ahead and call the Kaiser Planning Commission to order on Monday, February 8th as well, 2021.
Debbie, do you need to do roll call or will you get it from the participants list?
I've got it.
All right, so with quorum established and roll call, Mr. Witham, I will turn it over to you to introduce our presenters and take it away.
Thank you, Mayor Clark. Council, Planning Commission, thank you very much. Attendees that are viewing, we're glad that you're here and interested. So tonight we're doing this joint work session. It's a little bit different. We're, in the process of updating our buildable lands inventory and our housing needs analysis for Kaiser. This is a project that we did just, I guess, a year and a half ago about. June of 2019 was when we kind of had finalized this project and had identified deficiencies in our available lands for needed projected housing to accommodate our population. But we were also in the midst of doing our River Cherry Overlay District and the Kaiser Revitalization Plan. So we received funding through the state to do an update to our buildable lands inventory to basically look at what the RCOD, that River Cherry Overlay District, has created as far as additional capacities. So the normally in a housing needs analysis buildable lands inventory process, we would have a citizen advisory committee, which we did a year and a half ago. It was a pretty involved, long process. There were several meetings over several months, had a lot of engagement that did a lot of the groundwork for establishing baselines for assumptions that we were going to utilize. And we didn't want to recreate all of that in this very kind of focused update. So this is a little bit more of a show and tell tonight. And we're kind of utilizing Planning Commission and Council as our sort of our citizen advisory committee. It's a little bit different because we already kind of did that work. That being said, Beth Goodman with Echo Northwest, and Sadie, I apologize if I get your name wrong, but I believe it's Sadie DiNatale Berta. Yes? Okay, good. They're here with Echo Northwest, which is our consultant that's doing the work. And really with that, I'm going to turn it over to Beth. She has a presentation. She's going to walk us through a PowerPoint, and she can kind of go and if we can use the raise hand feature, that's great. But if you have pressing questions, feel free. It's kind of one of those deals that it's okay if it's a little bit free form. I think that Beth can handle it, and she's super smart, so she can answer everyone's questions, I'm sure. And with that, I will talk no further, and I will let Beth take it away.
Dana, I feel like you just issued the challenge, laid down the gauntlet for asking really hard questions. But I have to say that I really enjoy answering questions. So thank you very much for having us here this evening. As Shane mentioned, my colleagues and I had worked on Kaiser's housing needs analysis a number of years ago, and this is an update to that. So depending on your questions, we may well turn to Sadie for some information, where she's the keeper of some details. Here I am. I'm going to start sharing my screen. And give me one moment to adjust the windows so I can see everybody again. And I'm just going to step through this presentation. It's really going to go through an overview of what we're updating, talk about the update to the buildable lands inventory, the BLI, and then an update to the housing needs analysis. There's some more updates to come that we can't yet update because we're waiting for new information, which I'll tell you about when we get to there. And tell you where we're going out at the end of this, the next steps. So a housing needs analysis is really, it's part of your comprehensive plan. It's designed to answer questions about how much growth is the city going to see over the next 20 years in terms of housing and population? How much land do you have currently that's available for residential development? How much of it is vacant and unconstrained land? And answer the question, does Kaiser have enough buildable residential land to accommodate growth over the next 20 years? The answer here is no, but it's a very interesting answer because of your joint UGB, urban growth boundary, with Salem. And then we answered in the last project, and we haven't updated it substantially, the policies that are needed to meet Kaiser's housing needs. So as Shane said, Kaiser made substantial changes to its zoning code in implementing River Cherry Overlay District, which I always stumble over that, I apologize. So I'll probably just call it the RCOD, so I won't stumble as much. And with that, we're updating the majority of the buildable lands inventory. Where possible, we're holding key assumptions the same as we had it back in 2019. Because these assumptions had input from your advisory committee, we think it it reflects the understanding of the advisory committee. So where possible, we've been holding things stable. We are also coordinating land needs with the City of Salem. We had a meeting with Salem staff a couple weeks ago about this, and Salem is still in the process of analyzing the capacity of their housing. They're doing an update to the housing needs analysis that we did with City of Salem back in 2014 or 15. And they'll have their key findings back by early March. And City of Kaiser will continue coordinating with Salem on this. And we'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go a little bit further on. Before I go on to talk about the buildable lands inventory, does anybody have any questions yet? Okay. So the buildable lands inventory, or the BLI. What we do is we look at all residential buildable land in Kaiser's portion of the UGB. So all land that's zoned and designated and allowed to have housing outright. And that includes land in commercial and mixed use areas. We identify land that's vacant, land that's developed, land that can't be developed, say parkland. So it's exempt land or public land. And we also look at all of the constraints on your vacant land. So constraints are things like steep slopes, slopes over 25%, floodplain and floodway are constraints, wetlands are constraints. We may have some constraints in here about riparian areas, etc. So these are the same constraints that we used back in 2019 and 2018. We simply updated it, recognizing the RCOD, which you can see here in the little dotted line. This is all the vacant land that's unconstrained in Kaiser, including in the RCOD. What you'll notice about your land base, which I don't think will surprise any of you, is you don't have any big hunks of land anywhere that are undeveloped. Your land base is very, what we call, parcelized. It's scattered into lots of little little pieces of vacant land, which are harder to develop. And so when we looked at this in terms of acres of land, what we find is that there's 235 acres of land in areas that allow residential development. We didn't assume all of your commercial land develops with housing. We'll get to talking about that a little bit later, perhaps, nor the same thing with all of your mixed use necessarily. You see that we've divided land inside the RCOD and outside the RCOD. We're looking at different densities inside and outside the RCOD because your zoning code allows different things inside and outside. And so what we found previously is that there were 253 residential buildable acres back in 2019. And so now we're looking at 235. A confusing transposition of numbers. So there's been some change, but it doesn't hasn't been drastic change since then. Before I go on and start talking about housing need, do you have any questions about your buildable land? We'll talk about capacity of that buildable land for housing in a few minutes. Ms. Mayor.
So just to be clear, the change in the number of acres from 2019 to date, and Shane may know this answer, the decrease is because those lands got built on between then and now?
Yes.
Okay.
About 18 acres of land.
Okay. So we've been using it up, which is zero surprise to anybody. Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. Are there any other questions? Councillor Kohler?
Thank you. Out of that 86 acres that are in vacant lots now, are those pretty spread out?
Those are 73 acres in vacant lots. Now it was 86 before.
Thank you.
I would imagine that they are very spread out. All of your land is very spread out and very highly parcelized, meaning it's in little pieces.
Thank you.
Certainly. All right, any other questions?
Councillor Day.
On the, can you go back to that, that one. Partially vacant lots. Mm-hmm. What's a partially vacant lot?
So a partially vacant lot is a lot that has some development on it, but it can be subdivided and further developed without a change in zoning. And so if you imagine a 5-acre parcel that has one house built on it, or a 3-acre parcel that has one house built on it, we assume that the existing unit will stay and that the rest of the land will develop.
Okay. If I might follow up on that. So I'll just use my in-laws as an example. They have 1.25 acres with one house on it. I believe they could put up to, 3 on it. So are in your survey, are you assuming that at some, you're counting that, you know, like a lot like that as 3 and not one, even though like my in-laws have no intention of ever building another house on it.
Yes, we take the approximate area of their existing house. We take a little chunk of their lot and assume that that's not buildable. And then the rest of the lot, what's unconstrained, say if they had a little slope on it or a stream going through it, a wetland. The wetland or the stream, of course, wouldn't be developable. That's constrained. But what's left over, even though they have no intention of developing it, is considered potentially developable, yes. That's consistent with what Oregon's land use system requires us to consider with residential development.
So in a follow-up to that, so I live next to an example of that where the existing house had room in front and in back for additional houses, and those were built. So I now got behind me where there was one house and a very large lot. There's now house ADU.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of that's an example of what can happen in some of the older neighborhoods. So even though you have to keep track of those, there is nothing that says property owner, you have to do anything other than enjoy your property.
Correct. Correct.
This says, but property owner, if you want to do something more, make some money on your property, go for it.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and Councillor Kohler, go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you. So basically when it says 162 buildable acres in partially vacant lots, that may or may not ever be developed.
Correct.
Yeah, and the one thing I probably should have said at the beginning of this meeting is just that quick kind of reminder. When we look at a housing needs analysis and the buildable lands inventory, we're planning for what's called the planning horizon. So literally a 20-year look at, and that, because that's what the state law requires us as a city to do, is we're supposed to plan for our land needs based on population projections, looking out for 20 years. And so it is difficult because obviously we see areas, Councillor Day's in-laws neighborhood, for example, that has been on every buildable lands inventory since the beginning of time of Kaiser being Kaiser. Timothy Lane has always had these large acre and a half, 2 acre, 1 acre parcels with single houses on them. And we've seen two of those parcels develop, the ones all the way out at Clear Lake, and that's it in, you know, the 23 years I've worked here. So yeah, it is something that's a little bit difficult, but when we're looking at that buildable lands inventory, essentially Beth and Sadie and their team, they're using our GIS data and tax assessment data to look at what's on those parcels, what those sizes are. And ultimately, the one thing is we do have to a little bit remember with the housing needs analysis and the buildable lands inventory that it's not like a prescriptive, like this is what's going to happen. It's more of that this is what could happen. And we have to set some of those parameters. And it is not drilled down to a parcel by parcel analysis to determine if every single one of them can work, but it's kind of the best, it's more than a guess, but it's the best that we can do with that. So just as a kind of a little bit of an overview there.
Thank you, Shane.
And Shane, just so you know, because of the way the screen is, I can't see anybody. So if people are raising their, and if they don't use the raise hand, I'm not gonna know. So we might wanna pipe up, but I do see a raise hand from Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Beth, maybe you're going to go through this or maybe it's going to show here. Does it show here what kind of gain we got from the RCOD?
It does not show that here, but we could get that information for you.
Just curious. That's okay.
You definitely did get some gain because the assumptions we're making about development capacity are a little bit higher inside the RCOD, consistent with new regulations. Councillor Roth, Day, I'm sorry, you're muted.
Councillor Day, you're muted.
All right, let's see if I got that working. So I just want to make sure that we're clear. The analysis, the method of analysis is what is currently required in state law, right? Yep. Okay, all right, thank you.
Yes, sir. Awesome. Are there any other questions?
And I would encourage people to go ahead and use the raise hand so we're more likely to see you. We don't want anybody to not have a chance to ask questions as we go along, okay?
Yeah, I don't know how to do a raised hand thing. I don't see that here anywhere, so I will punt.
Okay, if you hit the participants button, it'll come up on the side and you'll see raise hand at the bottom of that panel.
You can also go to participants.
Yeah, hit the participants and then it'll be on the bottom of that panel.
And so Councillor Day is showing that his hand is raised.
Yep.
Don't forget to take it off after you're done.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had people leave it up there the whole time. It's like, yeah, I'm done. All right.
Okay.
The joys of Zoom. I think we're good for right now.
Okay, so the information, the buildable lands inventory isn't going to change before the end of this project. And this project, the grant ends by June 15th. So that's not going to change. But our next thing, when we start to look at how much housing are we going to need, we start with the question of how much population will the Kaiser portion of the Salem-Kaiser UGB have? Well, we've got an estimate right here between 2021 and 2041 that Kaiser will grow by 9,958 people, which is very similar to what we showed in the 2019-39 planning period, which is exactly what I would expect. Just a little tiny bit of difference because, you know, little different start years and end years. But the population forecast is about to be updated by the Portland State University Population Research Center. We should have a draft forecast sometime in March, and it will be official as of June 30th, 2021. And we've anticipated using that new forecast. And what will the forecast be? How much different will it be than this 9,958 people? I don't know. I genuinely have no guess. I'm hoping it's not very different, but that's the big thing that'll change. So our intention is to get the new forecast as soon as it becomes available. Echo Northwest and Shane would talk to each other identify if there were any concerns or issues with that new forecast. One thing about that forecast that's different than any other forecast is I believe it's supposed to explicitly separate Kaiser from Salem. Rather, this forecast is based on some analysis we did years ago when we were working with Salem and Kaiser on a housing needs analysis about how much population was in Salem, how much of it was in Kaiser.
Councillor Smith has her hand raised.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. If this forecast or their numbers come out and they're significantly different, what kind of an impact could that have on this entire study and going forward?
Could I tell you that at the end?
Yes.
Okay, I will tell you that, and you'll remind me if I forget, which I probably won't.
And just to remind people who weren't around for the food fight that used to be this whole population estimate thing between Salem and Kaiser as you're trying to parse out, you know, what part went between them. I'm really happy that now we've got this whole more, it's a better process going through Portland State than it used to be, because it was quite the fight. I think these numbers are more likely to give us a better idea with a better foundation of metrics than we've had in the past population forecast. That said, however, I agree with Beth. I don't think this is going to be wildly different than what we've seen, but we'll take some of the angst out when we can really look back at how these numbers were derived and the statistical foundation for it. And Beth, I saw that cracked you up, and you probably remembered.
It did. I worked very closely with Brandon Reich from the county on figuring out what the percentages would be. It was a fun few days.
Good times, great oldies. Kelsor Day.
So it is the angst that you're talking about. Is that about the accuracy of the numbers? Is that really what it is, or what's the? I mean, I think I understand. We want to know how many people are here and how many people are going to move here. And is it my sense is from what you're saying is we've got a better idea that whatever numbers we're given are more accurate than they used to be.
That is what I'm expecting. I'm sorry, Ms. Mayor.
So part of it was whether or not we were going to look at a slow, medium, or aggressive growth model. And part of it had to do with the fact that Kaiser was already pretty constrained 10 years ago. So there was a lot of discussion about whether the numbers being assigned to Kaiser would reflect what could happen if we didn't have the artificial boundary versus was that really a factor? And there was a lot of debate back and forth about how about these different constraints, whether they were statistically founded, and then where are we going to land? We ended up landing pretty much in the middle just because it felt like kind of a safe space. And it's pretty much worked out.
And the other thing is that when you're looking at a forecast like this, this is for the urban growth boundary. And so there are big parts of Salem that aren't incorporated. Within the urban growth boundary in Salem, but not part of the city limits. Parsing out those details is complicated. Are there any other questions before we go on? Okay. So we're not
go ahead and speak up.
We're not presenting to you a lot of information about housing affordability, except this slide. The housing needs analysis has a lot of information in it about housing affordability. So you'll have that if you want that. What we're looking at here is within Kaiser, looking at a distribution of existing households, these percentages. What they're describing is 13% of your households, for instance, right now, have incomes that are $21,000 or less. They're extremely low income, which is how HUD describes this group. And they're at 30% of the median family income for the Marion Polk County region. When we look at your forecasted new housing, which we will in a few moments, 13% of them in the future we're expecting to be in that same income category. I'll hop up here to the high income households. These are households with income above 120% of the median family income, $85,000 or more. About 37% of your households have income in that range. So we're assuming about that percentage of your households in the future will have income in that range. We don't try to forecast new incomes in the future, in part because that's extraordinarily complex. And my economist colleagues tell me that no economist worth their PhD really does that with a lot of accuracy. So the point here is that you've got households currently with a range of incomes, and you're expected in the future to continue to have households with a whole range of incomes. And this is really going to determine the types of housing that they can afford.
Question.
Yes.
So we are a severely rent burdened city. Where is that line drawn? Is that, I know the extremely low and very low would very likely fit into that category, especially since it looks like Kaiser is more of the high rent district. Low income.
So,
where does that fall on the spectrum?
Any household on this range could be cost burdened. Saying that they're cost burdened, we'll talk about renters. If a renter pays more than 30% of their income for housing, they're said to be cost burdened or rent burdened. If they pay more than 50% of their income for housing, they're said to be severely cost or rent burdened. And so for renters, you really wouldn't see in a place like Kaiser households in this group be severely or even cost burden if they were renters. Almost all your households down here are going to be cost burdened, and many of them are going to be severely cost burdened. Some of your households in this group are going to be cost burdened, and some of them, especially in this group, may be severely cost burdened.
So if we're looking at the question of quote unquote affordable housing, which is more tied to the median income,
yep,
would that fit more between the low and middle somewhere in there?
If so
look at that.
You've got two types of affordable housing at least. You've got your housing that's affordable, your households that can't afford market rate housing. Market rate housing tends to start at about 60% of median family income, a little bit on either side, depending on the community. But for Kaiser, I'm willing to bet that your market rate rents are right around 60% of median family income. And so these households down here that are below 50% of median family income, the housing that they can afford if it's newly built is almost exclusively going to be income restricted, low income, affordable housing of the type that's built by your housing authority or Oregon Housing and Community Services. When you talk about households between 50 and 80% of median family income and 80 and up to 100% and 20% of median family income, oftentimes what you're talking about is your middle income households. They also need housing that's affordable to them. It's often called workforce housing. When you talk about rental households, rental housing is newly built that's affordable to 50 to 80% of median family income. It just doesn't happen a lot. But between 80 and 100% of median family income, or 120% of median family income, that kind of housing does get built for rental. When you start talking about newly built single family housing that is for ownership, it's going to be clearly affordable somewhere here above 120% of median family income, and maybe affordable down here. So you talk about workforce ownership, affordable housing. I've got a lot of words. That's going to be, you know, down here between these two, essentially. So extremely low and very low income subsidized, low income and middle income. When you hear people talk about the middle, a missing middle housing and middle income housing, they're talking about these two groups here.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly.
Other questions?
Okay. So then up here we had 9,958 new people. Here we're starting with 9,958 new people. We're doing some calculations to get to number of new occupied units using things like average household size and an estimated vacancy rate from the census. The vacancy rate essentially takes your newly occupied housing units. Those are ones that we know based on average household size that you'll need. The vacancy rate inflates that a little bit by another 200 units. And so we're looking at 3,839 new dwelling units to accommodate new people in your coming to your city. And so from now on, we're talking about 3,800 new dwelling units. And these assumptions are fundamentally similar to what we did in the 2019. We simply used updated data. So before we were talking about 3,820 new dwelling units. So now we're just looking at a little higher.
Councilor Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So we're basically roughly talking about 200 units a year?
Yes. Any other questions before I go on? I'm happy to step back also if I lose anybody.
Councilor Kohler has another question. Or are you just playing with the raised hand?
No, where would we put 200 new units in Kaiser?
You've got a lot of little tiny parcels is where you'd put them. And we'll talk about that some. You don't have enough land for all this housing. So the next step we take, we're looking at percent of new housing by different housing types. So we've got single family detached, which we're assuming will be 63% of new housing. Single family attached, that's your townhouses. Duplex, triplex, and quads. And then multifamily with five or more structures per unit. And we're essentially making some adjustments for what you currently have. Give me one moment. I'm just looking off to the side on my screen. Fundamentally, still, we're planning for a lot of single-family detached housing. These two, the single-family attached and the duplexes, they're housing types that will be allowed in more areas by House Bill 2001. We're not assuming drastic increases in them, but some increases in those housing types. And this mix is consistent with what we assumed in the prior study. And that was the source of a fair bit of discussion in the prior study.
Question, are these the duplex, triplex, quadplex, are you assuming they're rentals or assuming that they're for home ownership or both?
They could be either. We're not making any tenure assumption on any of this. What you'll see in the housing needs analysis when you look at renter occupied housing, it's going to be a mix of all of these housing types.
So you're saying that the House Bill 2001 did not significantly change the assumptions based on assumptions for the kind of mix we're going to have because some of it was already permissive here?
I'm saying that we're not making, I'm not saying what House Bill 2001 did. I'm saying that we're not making a significant change in what we're assuming for future housing based on House Bill 2001. You may over time see a significant change, but given that Kaiser is largely built out, you don't have a lot of vacant land. You, if you can't get a subdivision, say of quadplexes, you can only get them on individual lots that are vacant or that redevelop. We think that redevelopment of existing neighborhoods with these new housing types, we think it's going to be very slow.
Got you.
Okay. So consistent with what we assumed in the prior study, we're assuming that there'll be a few new accessory dwelling units, about 50, which is about 2.5 per year, and a little bit of redevelopment of multifamily. And I think we now know where that redevelopment would go. It would go in the RCOD, where you have more opportunity now to focus more development. So that's a modest amount of redevelopment. And so that's taking down the number of new dwelling units to 3,629 that would be on vacant land. So this is an accounting thing. So here we go into yet more detail. What we're looking at is on your land that's low density, I'll just talk low density for a few moments. If it's inside the RCOD, we're assuming that in the future, it could develop with 8 dwelling units an acre, which is right in between the 6 to 10 dwelling units an acre that's allowed on LDR land in the RCOD. We're assuming that land that's low density residential that's outside of the RCOD will develop at 6.1 dwelling units an acre. And that is based on an analysis that we've done, I think, Sadie, since 2000, you can correct me if I'm wrong, of development that occurred in Kaiser on low density residential. And so the things outside the RCOD are what we've seen happen. And inside the RCOD is essentially the middle point for the most part. And I'll tell you the one exception. This percents of land and rights of way, when we look at your developed land and we say how much land is in roads in areas that are developed with low density, it's 21% of your land. We assume in the future that 21% of your land will need to be in rights of way. So we decrease that density to something a little bit lower, 21% lower. And so that's what the math in this table is doing. And this is giving a big table of assumptions that we'll be applying in a few minutes. Where have we assumed something different than what I just described is the medium density high residential inside the RCOD. This 20 dwelling units an acre, it is assuming that there's going to be some land that may well be rezoned from medium high density residential to mixed use. And so we're assuming the development of this parcel will be more consistent with mixed use, which is just a little tiny bit higher density than with medium density residential. It's the difference between 17 dwelling units an acre and 20 dwelling units an acre. Even if it stayed medium high density residential, that density is allowed.
Okay, I couldn't see where you pointed on the map. Was it something inside the RCOD?
It is inside. Can you guys see my cursor moving around?
I can see it moving, but it's really itty bitty tiny.
Okay, well, there's a brown splotch inside the RCOD right along Lock Haven.
It's like trail in Lock Haven, Madam Mayor.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, thank you.
And that's what we're talking about.
All right. So that wasn't, was that inside the RCOD or not?
It is currently.
Okay, so. And that, do you think, because it's a larger tract, if they choose to stop farming it and develop it, you think it's going to develop at the higher end of the medium high?
Yes, and Shane might well have some input on this.
Yeah, that was, and that's something that, you know, there's basically three big pieces left inside the RCOD, the two Isla Bay pieces and Don Earl's piece. And so with the Trail Avenue extension planned through there, and just some very precursory conversations we had during the revitalization plan process, when we're looking at that 20-year planning horizon, we do think it makes sense. I mean, we adopted it in the revitalization plan to upzone that parcel to mixed use. We didn't choose to move forward and do that right now, but I think from a long-range planning perspective, I think that would likely happen with the development of that property. I think it's something that's possible, and you know, it could totally go off the rails if some other user came in and he chose to sell it. You know, my whole life he's been farming it, and I don't expect that to change anytime soon, but maybe 20 years from now it does. And I think when it does change, it would make sense that it would change to a denser developed pattern. So that's kind of what we, as we looked at the map and different opportunities, that was kind of the one piece that we staff looked at and said, yeah, that's probably a pretty fair assumption for that piece. Now, that being said, if something changed down the road and it was something that ended up getting developed with some kind of medical office building or something like that, then we're going to be revisiting, you know, our buildable lands inventory and housing needs analysis down the road. And if things have changed in that built environment, that's kind of when we would capture that.
It's not a big difference. It's 45 dwelling units between the two different densities.
Okay.
Mr. Herrera, Councilor Herrera.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to back up a bit. When you talk about low density, does that only do single family homes or also like buildings with small units, a small amount of units in it? Is it only homes, single family homes? Sounds like a question.
Shane, can I get you to take this?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, so currently we're, yes, it is basically low density residential is our residential single family zone, which is primarily single family detached. But we do allow for single family attached, and with House Bill 2001, we will be allowing additional housing types on that land. So Beth, help me, but I believe that the state capped our assumption for any of those lower density lands that we could only increase them by, I think, 3%.
We didn't increase them at all.
Okay.
Because 3% is a ridiculous amount of increase. Yeah. It's negligible.
Yeah. So I think realistically, Councilor Herrera, that if in the next, you know, 5 years, we see actual development rates drastically shifting in Kaiser, then that's when we would have to kind of look and say, okay, now we go back and adjust the planning horizon because we're realizing differences that we can now quantify. I think that's one of the hard things with these kinds of studies that are, you know, pushing out in a 20-year planning horizon. It's very difficult to project. And, you know, I always appreciate Beth's, well, I guess he's no longer a coworker, he's kind of retired, but Bob Parker kind of led our project in 2019. And I will never forget our very first meeting at our CAC. He said, the thing you have to remember about population projections and housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventories is that no matter what you do, they are always going to be wrong. And I always appreciated that. And that's the one thing that we do, I want to make sure that we're reaffirming here, is that we're going through the process and doing the best effort we can with the information we have and the information we're looking at towards the future. But we are not viewing this as, you know, some sort of biblical truth, and this is thou shalt, and this is the only thing that will be. So anyway, does that answer your question, Councilor Herrera?
You more than answered it. In fact, you enlightened me in a couple of things. That's very interesting. I like the way you guys work. I think it's kind of cool. You answered my question, though.
Okay. Councilor Kohler.
Thank you. Does any of this take into account any industrial land?
No industrial land is included in this analysis now. That would be an economic opportunities analysis that would assess industrial land. I will mention that the city will be required to revisit this again every 8 years, as every city over 10,000 is now in Oregon required to revisit their housing needs analysis at least every 8 years. So. Are there any other questions before I go on and step you through this? Just a few more steps.
That's actually a good thing, because that gives us a chance to keep adjusting as we go and deal with the new variables. So.
Exactly.
I know we all enjoy doing studies, but I think that if we can adjust more often in smaller increments, we get a lot closer to the target.
One of the things that Bob has taught me over the years is that a shorter forecast period is more likely to be closer to accurate. So we take these densities here, the gross densities, and we apply them to your vacant land. So you've got 19 acres of buildable unconstrained land inside the RCOD that is in low density residential. That's 6.3 dwelling units per gross acre. You do the multiplication and you come out to a capacity of 120 dwelling units. This is all the math that you'd expect it to be, with the one exception here for commercial land that's outside the RCOD. You have 15 acres that is vacant. We assumed that six of it might develop in a with mixed use, so a mixture of commercial as well as housing, and then the rest of it we're assuming would just develop as commercial without any housing.
Councilor Day has a question.
Yes, sir. You're muted again, I'm sorry.
Here we go. So the 1665 units, that's a 20-year capacity?
Yes. You might remember we had a 3,600 unit forecast a few minutes ago. Our next slide will show you the subtraction and how that doesn't work out well. Commissioner Lawler? Sorry.
Lawyer. So the dwelling units, is that a term that's defined in terms of the size of the unit? So for example, are you talking units with two bedrooms, three bedrooms, overall capacity, or are we looking at just, you know, looking at the minimum standards for setbacks and all those other issues and applying that to the science here? Or what are your general assumptions in terms of what defines a dwelling unit?
A dwelling unit is can be anything from a studio up on to a mansion, you know, that has five or more bedrooms in it. So it can be any of those things. When you're thinking about dwelling units inside of your medium high density residential, or let's talk mixed use, that's clearly a multifamily dwelling unit. It's going to be in a multifamily structure. And the density outside the RCOD, let's just go with that. We're not looking specifically at setbacks, but we're looking at the development density that happened in these areas, like in the MDR outside the RCOD at 4.1 dwelling units per gross acre. So that accounts for things like setbacks, but we're not explicitly trying to build out each parcel. This is very much an average across all of your parcels.
So that would include, I understand this right, that's including a mixture of all the housing types, and you're making assumptions based off of an average, not. But I think, you know, what could be a dwelling unit for somebody that's used to living in New York City versus somebody that's in Idaho or Iowa is very, very different.
Yes.
So it's sort of a general assumption of all housing types. Got it. Okay, thank you.
It is. And it's based on what we've seen developing in Kaiser over time.
And the one thing I would add to that, Chair Lawyer, is that you know, we see that in that kind of in the day-to-day planning practices. Some properties will come in and they'll be able to capitalize and create a much more dense development plan because of the way a property is laid out, and some others don't or choose not to. And so it is something that we try to, well, I didn't try to, but the ECHO team tried to kind of truth that over. One of the things they look at when they're creating these is they do actually look at our permit histories too, and our subdivision and partitioning histories and what kind of densities we're achieving as we've been processing those over the past several years. So it is, I mean, it's not, it's definitely not perfect, but we think that it's realistic of what we've been seeing. So.
No, it makes sense. I mean, I think it gives folks an opportunity to digest this a little bit, because if you went into every single housing type, I mean, this list would be 400 or 500 slides long, because you got, you know, this is how many 1400 square foot houses, this is how many 2500 square foot houses. I mean, it'd be an impossible task, I imagine, to accomplish. So this is helpful.
And so since Shane brought up my coworker, who's still with us, even though he's semi-retired, Bob, what Bob and I would refer to that as all those little tiny assumptions is building a big house of cards that when you pull one of the cards out because one of your assumptions wrong, the whole thing just collapses. So this is a house of cards, but it's a more modest house of cards where we're trying to use averages to get closer to a reasonable answer. So then I'm going to take us to the to part of the answer here. So we look at the capacity of your different plan designations. And here we've collapsed the RCOD and, you know, outside and inside of it, just for brevity's sake, but we've still got that in the background. So we've got 834 dwelling unit capacity there. We're looking at, based on your mix of housing types and what's allowed in your different plan designations, a little more than 2,000 dwelling units in low density. You do your subtraction and you get negative 1,219 dwelling units. So you've got a deficit here at the densities we are looking at in low density. That's a 193 acre deficit. Also got a deficit in MDR of 747 dwelling units, or about 82 acres. When we take this a little bit further, which we're not showing you here tonight, we end up with a modest deficit in the MDHR when we're figuring in land for group quarters of about 5 acres. We're close to balanced on that. So the question ends up being, how are you going to accommodate these big deficits of housing? And so some of the discussion with Salem staff have been, does Salem have capacity for these housing units in their portion of the urban growth boundary? And Salem staff haven't been able to say definitively yes or no, because they're updating their information. But having worked with Salem's buildable lands inventory a few years ago, I don't expect their capacity is much less. They had a big surplus of land for single family housing, which this is predominantly single family detached, as well as the missing middle housing types that we've talked about a little bit. So things like duplexes through quads, townhouses, cottage housing, that kind of thing. So that's one option that we've been talking about. There's probably going to be a modest amount of land in your medium high density residential, like 5 acres is the current estimate. But that could be very, very different depending on what the different population forecast is, that Kaiser may well need to figure out how to accommodate in its urban growth boundary, portion of the urban growth boundary. And I would say that that's at least partially through through redevelopment or looking at opportunities for better using some of these slightly larger parcels. And you don't have very many slightly larger parcels. But those are that's modest questions that would have to be answered a little bit later. And Ms. Mayer, I can't hear you. I'm sorry. I'm still not able to hear you. So I think I'll try to call on okay. Commissioner Saldivar.
Saldivar, yeah. There we go. Now he's unmuted.
Yep, that works. My question, so these deficits, if I understand correctly, the units that the capacity, the 834 for the low density residential, we're using the small parcels. So we're assuming that the land that a homeowner has, that maybe they have an acre or acre and a half and they have one home on it, we're assuming that they're able to fill that or willing to fill those with dwelling units.
That's for your partially vacant land.
Yeah.
You've also got totally vacant land that we're assuming will develop.
Correct. But they are, this is also including the partially vacant land that's inside yes. there. So the reality is that, I mean, it's not likely that all of those partially vacant land homeowners are just going to wake up one day and put dwelling units on there. So the deficit is of land is much higher than in reality, right?
The deficit is probably functionally higher, yes. But it would be hard to claim officially.
Right. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Councillor Day?
Commissioner Saldivar asked my question, so.
All right.
I mean, part of the problem and advantage that Kaiser has is it is within the same, geographically close to Salem, which has gobs of land, as well as being within the same urban growth boundary. So the pressure for higher prices of land, which might lead to more development of partially vacant areas, that pressure is just not there the way it might be if the city was a few miles away from any other city.
Well, on top of that, we know that the property tax base from residential does not pay the freight for services, whereas some of the other house, other land use types that we're looking at from our recent cost of transportation, looking at employment lands, we know those lands come a lot closer to actually paying the freight for providing city services. So that's another issue that we're grappling with, especially with our artificially low property tax rate, that Salem has a different rate than we do.
That is true for many cities, I'll say that.
Yeah. We just happen to be the lowest lowest tax rate for a full service city in Oregon. So yay us. Chair Lawyer has a question.
Yeah, it's more just an observation. I think especially in the southeast part of the city, you know, there are some scattered lots in there. And I think what would be helpful, if only for illustrative purposes, there's some other zoning issues in there, both industrial and commercial, I think that could impact this overall conversation, specifically down along Chariot as you kind of get along the parkway and stuff like that. There's a lot of mixed opportunity in terms of both commercial and industrial zoning and stuff out there. So, you know, while we're not looking at necessarily industrial or commercial lands for purposes of the housing needs analysis, buildable lands inventory, I think it's important to kind of somehow be able to illustrate that as well, because you know, it is a function of how developers are looking at some of this land and whether or not they're going to want to try to build in some of those areas. Now, granted, RCOD allows for that with your mixed-use capacity, but I think that's a part of the story that we're not necessarily seeing here, especially in that lower southeast part of the city. So that was just kind of an observation as we're kind of looking through this. I mean, the rest of it, yeah, it makes sense. Southwest, those are larger lots and things like that, but you know, people might look at the southeast and go, why aren't people building here? Well, okay, there's, you know, storage units and there's other types of land use there that may not necessarily be compatible or, let me rephrase that, may not necessarily be desirable for residential to go into those areas.
Thanks, Matt. Anybody have questions, additional questions? I'm not seeing any hand raises and I can't see anybody who's doing this, so.
I don't see anybody who's doing that.
Okay. And we will be getting a copy of this presentation.
We have just a little bit more.
Okay, we'll keep going.
Okay, so as part of the 2019 study, we did a housing strategy, which the housing strategy basically looks at, at strategic issues like land supply and availability, and proposes some solutions to it. We're not substantially, I don't think we're editing that document particularly at all. The issues and the solutions haven't really changed since we did that report. But what Kaiser is going to be required to do a year after adopting the housing needs analysis is what's called a housing production strategy. And the housing production strategy, it focuses a lot more on affordability and issues of unmet housing need. A lot of what Kaiser might do is laid out in that housing strategy. So I would encourage the city to talk about that housing strategy at the right time. I'm sure Shane will tell you the right time, because there'll be more discussion about addressing these unmet housing needs, especially for affordability and ways to fund some of the changes that we've been talking about here. And with that, we'll be doing an update, a further update to this when we have the new population forecast. And I believe that we'll have a second joint meeting with you all, so you'll have a chance to see this again.
Okay.
So are there any further questions?
I'm not seeing anybody race to ask additional questions. A lot of food for thought, and this has been top of mind for both the Planning Commission and the City Council, as we recognize that being severely rent burdened and also the, squeezing people farther and farther away from our city centers, our urban areas, is just creating more and more economic segregation, which is not a desirable outcome. No easy answers, but that's why we're here, to find the good ones.
Indeed, ma'am.
All right. Beth, thank you so much.
Certainly.
Really appreciate the really good presentation and the work you've done. Shane, do you have anything that to share with us to wrap this up and next steps?
Yeah, just really quickly, again, I want to echo that and just thank you, Beth and Sadie, for all your hard work getting us to this point. Obviously, I guess for me, in seeing the numbers, and I did see them before tonight, but just I think last week we talked. And I think that at the end of the day, what it does show us is that we did realize some additional capacity with our River Cherry Overlay District. Specifically and most significantly in the area of the possibility of additional multifamily redevelopment, which when we revisit back in our minds to that process we went through for 2 years, I was encouraged by that, because that was kind of some of the outlying goals that we were trying to look at and figure out how we can create a little bit more of a denser fabric in our quote unquote downtownish core along River and Cherry. I think that clearly moving forward, kind of the first step is knowing what those numbers are. And then really the next steps are figuring out, okay, how do we best move forward and plan accordingly, recognizing that the RCOD was not the silver bullet that solved all of our growth needs. Nobody expected it would be, but now we kind of are going to have a document that kind of spells out exactly what we were able to solve and where the deficiencies still remain. So I think that, obviously there are going to be some significant policy implications as we move forward to figure out how Planning Commission and Council wants to guide us as we move forward. And I think that, clearly with the work that was done in 2019, we want to kind of keep that in the forefront of our minds as to how we do that. So I do appreciate you all being here and listening. And like I said, I will get the, or maybe Debbie will get the presentation sent out to everybody because she has the mailing lists. And then as we get additional information, we will get you that as well. So
we have a question from Councilor Reed.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I guess, again, knowing that this is kind of a fuzzy process to begin with, we've seen quite a lot of development that 18 acres have happened between 2019 and now. What do we get to count, I guess, in all of this is, because we keep doing these, or this is, I guess, the update to the 2019 study. Do we get to count the development that we've been doing towards our requirements of providing housing, those housing capacity for the next 20 years? Does that make sense? Or is it just an ongoing process? We just need to make sure that we're on track as best as possible. Is that really the material point?
So, Councilor Reed, I'm going to do my best. Your internet hates you right now, so I was having a little bit of a hard time of hearing everything. But I think that the gist of it was. Are we getting kind of the credit for what we've done in the past in the last couple of years as we move forward? And I would say that yes, this update is kind of looking at that. From a planning perspective, from the guy who's supposed to get these kinds of studies adopted and comprehensive plans updated, when we went through the 2019 study, we showed this deficit. And you can't adopt a housing needs analysis and a buildable lands inventory and update your comprehensive plan accordingly when you show a deficit. So the, ultimately on one hand, and again, this is not meant to be a policy statement. That is not my role and not what I'm trying to say at all. But I think that what this study does is it gets us to a point where we would theoretically or hopefully be able to actually adopt this study and update our comprehensive plan accordingly if coordination with Salem works and if we can demonstrate that those things can be accommodated. But I think clearly the elephant in the room is always the UGB discussion and what do we do and how do we do that? And when do we have to do that and those kinds of things. And I think that's hard because I think a lot of that is policy driven, but you clearly have to also have the data to support that you have the needs. And I think that what these updates, what this specific update is giving us is it's giving us a very realistic understanding of what our real need is. I think that if we had done nothing with the River Cherry Overlay District, if House Bill 2001 did not come into existence, then that 2019 study would be like, well, that's what the numbers are. Now we have to do something different. And so there are a lot of different things that cities could choose to look at and do. Although I think that whenever you look at one thing, it kind of triggers another. And, speaking back to what Chair Lawyer had kind of alluded to is we have some areas that are zoned industrial that are in housing right now, some of it, theoretically, from a comprehensive plan perspective, we could look at doing some major rezoning in areas of town. That's not something that gets covered by a housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory process. But that might be something that has to be looked at from a policy perspective as a strategy of actually rezoning lands that could be redeveloped at different rates. Obviously, it sometimes we, it, me, I'll, it's not we, it's me. I tend to oversimplify it because I'm a Kaiser kid. I've lived here forever. I remember when things weren't. And so in my mind, I think of what I've seen built in my lifetime and my career here, and I automatically assume that that's what we're going to just continue to always see. And I think the one thing I will say is in, you know, in 2000, we adopted our infill standards because we were compressed with land way back 20 years ago. And we have seen a change in the types of developments that come in Kaiser versus having large greenfield lands that you can develop as kind of standardized subdivisions. And so I think that needle continues to move that direction. But I do think there's that balance that we as a city have to kind of determine and figure out, well, at what level is too much for our city, and really just kind of where we are at. And, you know, we are, it's a unique perspective for us to be in Kaiser. We are the last shared UGB in the state of Oregon that's like us. And I know sometimes that can be viewed often as being a sort of a shackling and a bad thing, if you will. The flip side of it is it actually gives us some opportunities that other entities would not have when we look at how we plan for future growth. So, Councilor Reed, I don't know if that answered your question fully, but hopefully that helps a little bit.
Thank you, Shane. That was helpful to me as well. I appreciate that. Any other questions from the Planning Commission or City Council? Okay, I'm not seeing any hand raises at this point. Again, good food for thought. Beth, you had a closing thought?
Councilor Herrera has his hand up.
Oh, okay. I've seen it go up and down. So, Councilor Herrera, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Mayor. Thank you, Shane, for that. You answered part of my questions in terms of your explanation there. And thank you, Beth, for your presentation. I want to thank the whole commission. You guys have done some great stuff here. And I know this is, I wasn't going to get here until you said urban growth boundary, but as a planning commission, do you look ahead in terms of, I know you're a planner, Shane, and are you looking ahead in terms of funding and stuff like that? I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but it seems to me that we're headed that direction. And just by the data that we see here, and I just, you know, I know we're not probably not supposed to bring that up yet, but I keep wondering, are we looking ahead in terms of that direction, funding and whatever it's going to take with the city of Salem or whatever we have to do? And you mentioned being the last shared border. That's really something to... it's really interesting, and I just wondered if you look ahead in those terms. I know there's work to do. We're away from it. I've been hearing this for over 10 years, and I know that we're heading that direction. And I just nobody wants to talk about it for some reason. But I just I've been here over 40 years, and I've seen a lot of stuff, and I know which way we're going. I can see the data too. But thank you very much for your presentation. I think it was very rewarding. Informative. So that's my two cents. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor.
Chair Lawyer has a question.
No, I just want to find one final thought on this. I know that a lot of these are goals, and they're kind of establishing, what we're limited to and what we're trying to move towards. But I think we also need to kind of keep in mind what Kaiser's housing market is like right now. And that's that folks that are currently in lower value homes that are trying to move into higher value homes are not able to do so. So folks that maybe bought a $160,000 home 5 or 10 years ago and now have the ability to move into something different, the capacity is not there for that. And I think that goes even further down the economic line, whereas you're talking about folks that may be currently renters. As we build into a lot of these areas, I think we just need to be mindful of not accidentally starting to gentrify some of those neighborhoods, especially with rezoning and some of those other issues. We look at Southeast Kaiser and, some of the older parts of town. And while the concept of this RCOD and all of these thoughts are great, the reality of it is, folks that may have taken that land and tried to redevelop it now maybe can't even afford to live on the land that they just redeveloped. And so just got to be mindful, I think, as we kind of talk about the philosophies and our desire to kind of get to this impasse so that we can start to look at a UGB expansion, that we don't inadvertently put ourselves in a position where we're not thinking about our neighbors that are lower income and basically forcing them to move out of the city because they can't even afford to stay in the city they want to live in. And so it's just, you know, it's just one of those things that I'm sensitive to. And, you know, planning is great, but also looking at reality and understanding that, you know, a home should not increase. Well, it's great that homes, you know, increase by 100% in a matter of 5 or 6 years. But it makes it very, very difficult for people in Kaiser to, you know, go from an apartment to a house, and it's nearly impossible for them to build. And so just a statement on just being mindful as we look forward. And you know, that's a really good argument as we have a conversation, I think, moving forward about an urban growth boundary is, you know, it's, once land becomes available, it's going to be extremely expensive, I think. And we just got to be mindful of that and, you know, let the developers do what they need to do. But anyways, that.
Well, I think part of this is also going to be some very informed conversations with state agencies such as Oregon Housing and Community Services. These numbers will allow us to make requests or put in for grants or form partnerships for keeping affordable housing affordable, especially the entree into home ownership, which we know is the foundation for building a solid financial future for families. And we want to make sure it is accessible to a very diverse population, people who are coming from generations of homeownership and new homeowners within families and groups. So these are very things we're very mindful of as we're looking at any policies that will move us forward, not just on the number of dwelling units, but the accessibility to those dwelling units. And creating that very solid space for families to thrive. Councillor Day, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I had a question for Beth. Earlier in her presentation, she said that Salem is working on their analysis. They'll have key findings by mid-March. Is the only... My question, and everyone on the council is going to roll their eyes when I ask you this question, but why do I care about the city of Salem? Is it because we share the urban growth boundary with them?
Yes, and one of the options for accommodating your deficit of housing is through Salem taking on that deficit.
And in terms of, you know, our periodic review or whatever you want to call it, in order for us to come into compliance and get through that whole fun process, is the city of Salem going to have to agree to take on some of our deficit?
I'm going to defer to Shane.
Yeah, so it's a little bit hard because we're in a public meeting, so I'm going to be careful about how I say this exactly, because I'm definitely not the state of Oregon and I'm not a lawyer. But arguably, the short answer would be yes. I mean, there would have to be an acknowledgement if that's where the deficit was being accommodated. The entities in the SCAPAC group, mm-hmm. Marion County, Salem, Kaiser, Polk, the whole group kind of has to look at that as saying, yes, this is okay, from a simplistic view. I think what's difficult is because the state planning program governs urban growth boundaries and not exactly cities, we are in a weird spot. Again, and you know that we have the famous kind of divorce memo from a few years ago, which kind of outlined if we were completely separate from a shared UGB and we had our own UGB, we would be required to plan for all of our land needs in our planning horizon for all of our land types. But because we're in a shared UGB, clearly a lot of job shed is not in Kaiser. We don't have enough jobs specifically in Kaiser for the number of people that live in Kaiser. And we don't have enough land for the projected population growth within the region if we're assuming a certain number for Kaiser. So it's kind of a chicken and an egg, in my opinion. And I have never gotten a true straight answer from anyone at the state, because I think nobody quite knows how we're supposed to deal with it. I mean, I think the flip side of the coin, and I kind of have said this a little bit flippantly in the past, was, well, okay, we have a deficit, but we have a shared UGB, so we don't have to do anything then. Right.
It's our problem with the city of Salem.
Right. So I think that's, but the flip side is that obviously in order to have our housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory acknowledged, we have to demonstrate that we are implementing things like efficiency measures and planning for our growth responsibly. I think that realistically, and this was where kind of speaking back to what I said earlier, I was encouraged that the work we did in the RCOD demonstrates that we've created more capacity, especially in that multifamily genre of housing types, because I think that would be the hardest to get Salem to be able to take, because they already kind of show that they need more multifamily housing in their area as well. Whereas the single family there, yeah, again, I don't remember if it was 2015 or 16 that Salem did an update, but they had a huge capacity for additional available lands in the area. And so for us to go and say, hey, we're going to expand our UGB with this shared boundary, we like don't hit step one when it comes to the state statutes and rules for needing an expansion because of those reasons. Yeah. Unless we were completely divorced. So.
Okay. I have one more question, if I may. And is the requirement for a housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory, is that an obligation that's imposed on cities, or is it imposed by urban growth boundary?
It's imposed on cities now. And so it used to be that we went through periodic review and it was supposed to happen a certain amount of time every so many years. I've been here for 23 years and we went through periodic review twice during my time working here. Periodic review is kind of no longer, it's not really happening anymore the way it used to. But what they did do, and Beth spoke to it earlier, we are under compulsion now because of the size of our city to do a housing needs analysis every 8 years. So when that law passed, we were already in the midst of updating our housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory. So the expectation is that we are able to adopt this study and then we won't have to do this again for another 8 years by state law.
So Commissioner Grenz had a question.
Yes. So what do we do when Salem officially has a deficit? I know part of their housing needs analysis that they're going through right now, they're also doing a very good comprehensive plan adjustment, and I think frantically looking for properties that they can rezone to multifamily because they're so deficient. What do we do when they're deficient as well?
Yeah, I think, and I don't know if Beth may have more insights than me, but just from an overall state planning goals perspective, I think that we would be in a very different point of conversations and talking about policies and how to move forward if the region was compressed. Then I think, I mean, how do I say this? I'll just say it bluntly because whatever, that's how I am. I think that if that were the situation, then I think we, the city, collectively should be at the table big time advocating for our needs in the shared region. I think what's hard is it's sort of like we have, you know, already three strikes against us if we're looking at expansion with the situation that we're in right now. But if Salem were in a place where there was a true deficit of the land types and a UGB expansion were happening, then I think that it would be at that point, it's not about whether or not a UGB expansion is merited, it's about where does it happen, if that makes sense.
And if we thought the population numbers were a food fight, this would be an epic one.
A very complicated epic one.
Yeah.
Yes, it would, very much so. But I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, we've had a number of conversations about the expansion for Kaiser for employment land, again, for the part of the reason that we discussed earlier, but also the opportunity to, for people to live and work within, you know, our metro area, our urbanized area, which is one of the goals, especially under the transportation planning rule. And now what they're looking in terms of the coordination of the statewide transportation strategy for the greenhouse gas. And so these are areas that we will also have to factor in where we grow, how we grow, that will look at more comprehensive livability rather than per dwelling unit. You know, however, can we stack people versus where can living, neighborhoods, employment, associated services all kind of come together. Additional questions or comments? We're coming up to the bottom of the hour, which is when we're scheduled to adjourn. So any closing thoughts, Chair Lawyer?
No, thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Witham.
Now I just want to thank everybody for being here and all the good comments and the input. We appreciate it. And really, thank you, Beth. Thank you, Sadie. This is really helpful for us. So.
Beth, Sadie, anything to wrap up?
Thank you very much for having us here. We look forward to talking with you again.
Looking forward to that as well, as we figure out how we're going to house the members of our community. The time is 7:30. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a great conversation and we are adjourned.
Good evening.